Hey, it's Brandi Cruz. You're listening to an Election 2024 interview with Congressman Dan Newhouse, a Republican who's running for re-election to Washington's 4th Congressional District. Congressman, welcome back to Undivided.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you in person, actually.
Here. What a treat. You're over here on the western side of the state, slumming it.
And I got to say, it is beautiful over here today.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice weather. Well, it was fine. I was over there. We were just over in your neck of the woods this past weekend. It was gorgeous out there, too.
It's my favorite time of year.
Yeah. So how have you been with campaigning? I mean, it's
busy.
Always busy.
Busy time of year for sure, campaign-wise, going all over. I've got a big district, as you know.
Yeah.
And lots of communities, lots of events going on. And so, yeah, very busy. But things are happening fast.
Yeah, it's been an interesting race. As you know, nothing's off limits. And so I want to talk about the primary a little bit. The Tiffany Smiley thing was a freaking curveball. Was that a curveball to you?
As far as her joining, getting into the race? Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise because, you know, I supported Tiffany 2 years ago and we've always been on good terms. In fact, several weeks before she told me what she was planning, we've been talking about potentially doing some events and stuff together. Yeah. So yeah, it was a bit of a surprise. It took me by surprise.
Were you offended?
You know, it's free country. People can do whatever they want. She had her eyes set on running for office. You know, I was surprised, just but shocked.
Well, I'd heard that she might be interested in running for your seat after you retired. Okay. And so I guess I was just surprised that it happened before you retired. Did she ever tell you why?
Gosh, Brandi, she said it was a very short conversation. She wanted to meet me in D.C. because she was on the East Coast to do some, I don't know, some filming or something. And we sat down and she pretty much just laid it out what she was planning to do, mainly because she figured it was her time. So,
like you say, free country. I love the drama. I'm sure you love the team, hate the drama, but I just love hearing about it.
Well,
it's interesting. You know, the polling before the primary, her camp released a poll putting her at like something like 50% or something. And that's obviously not what the results showed. So for you guys going into that primary situation, it being such a red district, I mean, did you feel like her candidacy would hurt you or hurt Jared more?
Well, you know, like I said, I've been a supporter of Tiffany when she ran 2 years ago. I think a lot of her. I think she has a lot of abilities and a lot of potential. So going into that, sure, my preference would not have been to run against Tiffany Smiley. That would have been a difficult race personally. And yeah, she's a great candidate. So, you know, I guess from that perspective, the results turned out just about how I wanted him to. I think Mr. Sessler, on the other hand, is a better opponent for me to have. There's a lot more difference between him and I than between Tiffany and I. So a lot bigger contrast.
Yeah, well, obviously we'll spend more time talking about that. It's interesting. We don't often, especially over here, have conversations about races between two Republicans. Hell, we sometimes have a lot more conversations about races with no Republicans in them. So, you know, it's much different than the congressional campaigns we've covered where it's a Republican versus a Democrat. The differences are pretty clear. So between you and Jared, I mean, there are going to be similarities, right? But what are some of the differences that you're highlighting as you go out and campaign?
Well, we're both Republicans, so yes, that's a similarity. But there's a lot of differences. And you know, I'm on the west side of the state, so I'll be careful how I put this.
You don't have to be.
Okay.
Yeah, you're fine.
But Jared Sessler is from the west side of the state. He just moved to eastern Washington, I don't know, in the last couple of years. So to me, nothing wrong with people over here, but the issues that people face in eastern Washington are different than they are over here. You know, I'm from there. I'm born and raised in the Yakima Valley. I truly believe that those things that I know, that the challenges that I face on my farm, in my community, you know, the same things that people up and down the central Washington face, and that I truly understand them more so than someone who just moved in from the west side of the state in the last couple of years. So that's a huge difference between us. And I think you can see that in some of the things that he has said recently and over the last couple of years. For one, he's got a thing against the meat and dairy industry. You know, I guess some people have told me he's a vegetarian. That's fine.
That's the first I've heard of that.
Doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think Tiffany Smiley made that point in her campaign. Oh,
he's a vegetarian, eh?
I don't know. But he has made some statements against the animal industry on how those products are bad for you, that they're going to kill you, and has had some ideas on what to do to drive people away from those for their health. Mm-hmm. And so in my district, we raise a lot of animal products, you know, a lot of cattle, a lot of dairy. So that's a big part of our economy. And if you don't raise cattle or you don't milk cows, a lot of farmers raise the feed for those animals. So it impacts a lot of people. And I just think that that's one example of how we are different and how, you know, I guess people can hold all their own perspectives and opinions. But that's really contrary to a lot of the people in my district and a good example of how sometimes West and East don't always see eye to eye. You know, he's also been advocating, and this has been over a period of a couple of years that we've looked at, advocating a tax on everything that you purchase, up to 30%. And that's a very dangerous position to take in this economy right now. The inflationary pressures, the increases in costs of everything, that's something that a lot of people are very concerned about adding to the bills that they have to pay already.
I haven't heard about that. A tax, like in terms of like at point of sale, or is he talking about like a tariff as a tax, or what is he?
I think it's a point of sale kind of an idea.
I would have to look more into that because that sounds like an extreme leftist position. So I don't know what the justification for that would be.
Apparently, he thinks it's more fair. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. You know, we can't have this conversation about the differences between you and Jared without talking about Donald Trump. I mean, he essentially, that has been one of the main focuses of why he's running, how he's campaigning, is like, you're the congressman who voted to impeach Donald Trump. How has that manifested on the campaign trail for you? Is that an issue that is brought up a lot?
Oh, he makes sure it is because that's the only thing he's got, really. Because if people are asked, they agree with most everything that I do. And not, you know, not 100%, obviously, but most of the things that I stand for and the votes I've taken, the things that I've accomplished have been really good for my district and the people in my district. The one vote, the impeachment vote, I don't hide behind it.
No.
I stood up for the Constitution that day. And that's a big issue for a lot of people on both sides. Some people just can't get beyond it and will never support me. And a lot of people maybe didn't agree with it, but recognize all of the other things that I've been able to do while I'm in Congress and are still supporting me. And then, frankly, there's a lot of people that come up to me and say, thank you for standing up for the Constitution. So I know that's a big issue. It certainly is. If it weren't for that one issue, I may not even have an opponent, you know.
Right.
But that's where we are. But I think that we're going to be successful disregarding that. People will still look at the bigger picture and see what's most important here.
Well, I always have to wonder, and I'll just be, you know, transparent to viewers, is, you know, I've supported your campaign. I support you because I think that you're an ethical person. I think you are who you say you are. I've really come to respect and appreciate you over the years, you know, from really since that vote. And I think that's the first time I'd ever interviewed you. And it really didn't have anything to do with that. But I think there's always something for me where when someone does something that they know won't be good for them politically, to me, it's a sign of character because I'm like, well, clearly their priority isn't getting back in office. So maybe that's a good person. So just in full transparency on that. But, you know, with that individual vote, something I brought up with you in the past is there's got to be a reason you're the only one left. You know what I mean? There's got to be a reason of all the Republicans who voted to impeach him, you're the only one who survived.
Well, there's two of us, actually.
Who's the other one?
David Valadao.
Oh, in California. You're right.
Central California.
Yeah. Why do you think that is, though? So few.
Well, there was only 10 to begin with.
Yeah.
Several were at the point of retirement, so they decided that that was the case. Several got beat in their next primary, and some couple just decided not to run.
Yeah.
And so a lot of varying reasons. I don't know that, you know, that you could say that because that vote, that's why they're not there anymore. You know, Fred Upton, for instance, he'd been in, gosh, I'm not even sure. He'd been in Congress like 30 years or something like that. He just felt it was time for him to go. And I think there was some redistricting that had happened, and he'd have to really work hard to get elected and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of different reasons. And certainly, in, for instance, Liz Cheney's case, that was the reason that she's no longer in Congress.
Right.
She lost big time in her state of Wyoming. But like I said, the description I've made of the people in my district, last time, that, you know, 2 years ago, the first election since the impeachment vote, I won with 66% of the vote in the general election, you know, after getting through a closer primary. And so I think for the most part, and to their credit, people in Central Washington are looking at the bigger picture. I agree with Dan on 90% of the things. Maybe there's one or two votes or a couple things I don't agree with him on. But overall, he's doing a good job. That kind of thing. And I get that a lot.
Well, maybe they didn't like it, but they're like, well, you know, we still like him. We can look past that. But on the, you know, so much of what's happening at the national level, obviously, is going to influence all the down ballot races.
I agree.
Not the Trump thing is an issue here. Any Republican congressional candidates on this side of the Cascades, they absolutely will not. Don't want to talk about him. Don't want to touch it. Different scenario over there. I mean, have you taken a position in the presidential race on who you're going to vote for?
You know, I've told people time and time again, I'm a lifelong Republican.
Yeah.
I've never voted for a Democrat.
Oh, you're not going to vote for Kamala Harris?
That would be a really tough thing to do. Yeah. I truly think, Brandy, and you can appreciate this too, I think Republican priorities, Republican policies, the direction that Republicans want to take the country are truly better in the long run. I've many times described the kind of the socialist direction that the other party wants to take us. So that it would be very hard for me to not vote Republican.
So you're going to vote for Donald Trump?
That's my plan.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear that, because with Kamala Harris, I mean, I think that's the issue, is like, you look at how extreme she's been. I mean, and you see the turn Liz Cheney has taken. What do you make of the fact that Liz Cheney went out and endorsed Kamala and is campaigning for Kamala?
Well, you know, Liz truly sees this as a make or break moment for the country. And so, you know, I respect her opinion. I really do. You know, certainly we came to the same conclusion of the results of January 6th. And I respect her, you know, willingness to stand up for what she believes.
Sure.
So that's not easy. You tried to, and I think you did a decent job of describing the way I felt that. Actually, it was on January 13th of that year, when we did the vote. I knew that it would probably politically not be the best thing for me.
Yeah.
But I felt it was the right choice, and I still do.
I still do.
I think, you know, standing up for the Constitution, the oath that we take every time we come into office, not unlike the oath that members of our armed services take, or those that protect us, public safety take when they are hired. They're not just words on a paper. They got to mean something. And I took that to heart, and I'm willing to accept the consequences either way, because I think I made the right choice.
Yeah. And that's what I've seen, is I think you did what you thought was right, and then you moved on and you went back to, like, sort of, okay, what's happening with my district? And you didn't turn it into like your key personality trait, discussing it and revisiting it. You only have to revisit it when you come talk to me, and I make you rehash everything, right? But in seriousness, when you are out there campaigning, huge district, as you said, what are the top issues for the folks in your district right now?
I think, not unlike the rest of the country, people are truly struggling under the high cost of living these days.
Yeah.
You know, inflation has been up, but it's been all over the place. But prices of things are high. Gas is starting to come down in the state of Washington, interestingly, right before November. I don't know how that works, but we were even ahead of California at one point for highest gas prices in the country. But, you know, a trip to the grocery store, it's truly an investment. Oh my gosh, cost a lot of money. And so that's high on people's minds, the cost of living, you know, the cost of housing, gasoline and groceries, those kinds of things. And even beyond that, though, you know that I come from a very agricultural district, Central Washington. the farming community, the agricultural industry is truly struggling because those high prices aren't limited to just groceries. Every input that farmers have to buy to produce the crops that, that clothe and feed Americans in the world are up. The cost of those things are high, and the cost of the price that we're getting for our products we produce have not kept up. And so it is really tough out there in ag country right now. And that's a huge issue that people bring up to me. And then, you know, we're not, I don't know why, maybe it's because of the centralized news or the social media and all those things. Issues that are important, say in Michigan, are important in Washington too, or in Texas or mm-hmm. California, wherever you go. Things like the border are huge. Yeah. That's a huge issue in Central Washington.
We got a lot of, I hate to say it, there have been a couple of major Homeland Security investigation things into fentanyl trafficking that have wound up right smack dab in the middle of your district.
Oh, that's right. That's exactly where I was going with that. Yeah. We're not a state that's on the southern border, but we've got Canada right up north. We've got the, you know, the seaports that we have in mm-hmm. Washington State. And we get a lot of, this won't surprise you, but a lot of people coming up from the southern United States bringing drugs.
Yeah,
we're the main line coming up from Southern California and Arizona, bringing drugs up in Central Washington and then distributed throughout the country to Seattle, Chicago, everywhere else. And that's a huge issue for communities in Central Washington. This fentanyl thing is dire. It's a crisis. It truly is. I just saw some numbers the other day, and I can't recite them to you, but overdose deaths are starting to go down nationwide, mm-hmm. except in Washington.
Yeah. It was from Axios.
Ah.
Yeah. We are bucking some of the worst overdose rates and some of the worst rates for business growth at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm.
Not a good place to do business here in the state of Washington.
No, and we saw, I mean, it's also, you know, it's not just overdoses. In your district, I had talked to Homeland Security Investigations. I mean, they had the drug cartel who killed two people who were working with the police out in Central Washington, buried them in a field somewhere. And so there's a level of violence that comes along with the fentanyl crisis as well. On that topic, though, because there's some, so former President Donald Trump has this mass deportation plan that he says he'd institute. And I want to tie these things together. I mean, do you support any form of mass deportation?
The question I would have there, and look, those people should not have been allowed into the country to begin with. How do you go round them all up? Logistically, I don't know how you do that.
Right.
So I'm interested to see the details of that plan work out, play out, because, you know, certainly there's been a lot of pressure put on communities around the country. It was interesting to see some of the, you know, Democrat mayors of cities all of a sudden change positions when they see this whole mm-hmm. influx of people coming in, that their resources were being overtaxed and overburdened. They couldn't deal with it.
Eric Adams. Well, now he's under an indictment. I'm sort of like, well, that's weird, but yeah.
But that's exactly what the communities in Arizona and California and Texas and those border communities mm-hmm. have been under this siege for a long time. So I fully appreciate the sentiment behind that. I want to see the details. Yeah. And when we were talking about fentanyl a minute ago, I put together something called the Central Washington Fentanyl Task Force. Mm-hmm. And we're coming out with our report here soon. It's been about a year and a half plus that we've brought together about 30 or so people, kind of people come in and out a little bit, of experts in the field of whether it's law enforcement, whether it's in the medical community, whether it's in the judicial community, whether it's in the mental health community, some of the counselors, some of the people that are engaged in this issue, trying to keep people off of drugs. And then what do you do when they're on drugs? Trying to rehabilitate them. People engaged in schools, trying to come together. What can we do to help solve this problem? And so I'm excited about that. The only one in the country that I know of. And then I'm also part of the Select Committee on China. And through that, the chairman asked me to head up the fentanyl working group. So we're looking at ways that we can address this from the bigger picture, from the federal government as well.
Because those ingredients, they're coming, that's still the primary belief, right? The ingredients are coming in through China into Mexico and up.
You know what we found out? And this will set you back. 97% of the fentanyl and fentanyl precursors come from China.
Yep. There it is.
And what we learned was that the CCP, the Communist Chinese Party, encourages, incentivizes, rewards companies that produce this stuff. It's illegal in China, but export it. And guess where most of it comes?
Well, you look at the impact it has, it devastates our economy. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier those stats with, you know, our overdoses are trending, you know, and then business growth is down. Like there's
got to be a relationship.
100%. But the reason I asked you about the mass deportation in the context of fentanyl and all of that. So, you know, I think there's a lot of people who get on board with, you know, people who've come here, committed violent crimes or whatever, like let's get them out of the country ASAP. What I worry about with how bad the border crisis has gotten, how bad the fentanyl crisis has gotten and all of that, is this sort of like broader blowback for immigrants, the immigrant workforce, because your district, and you mentioned the farmers and the ranch, they rely so much on that immigrant labor. And so I guess, you know, how do we make sure that there's like the two things are being bifurcated? It's like, okay, you go after the illegal immigrants who are here breaking the law, but like we also need to have more people coming in here on work visas to help with our economy.
So glad you brought that up. And I've been working on this issue since I've been in Congress, actually, that trying to figure out ways that we can improve the visa program that allows agricultural workers to come and work in the ag industry. And we've had some successes there. Twice we've passed a bill through the House of Representatives, the first time since the 1986 that major immigration reform has passed the House. We can't get it, have not been able to get it through the Senate yet, but it's it keeps we keep chinking away at that. And recently, we've had a growth in the momentum. People on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, recognize that we have to make some changes to just exactly what you're talking about. Those vehicles or those visa programs that allow people to come to our country legally, provide us with employees, in industries that we absolutely need, and then allows them to travel back to their home country without the fear of not being able to come back. That's why they stay. Once they come in, once they've gone through that whole coyote system and risk their life to come here, they're not going to go back home for Christmas, because then they'd have to go through all that again.
Yeah.
And so we need to have that way for them to come and go, because we need them. We need, and so separating those people from the criminal element and those people that are just coming here for who knows what, we've got to make that bifurcation. We've got to make that separation. And I've been saying this all along. If we can reform those systems, that's going to take a tremendous amount of pressure off the border, take the incentive away from people who are trying to get here illegally.
And that's what there are people who want to come here and make a better life for themselves, and they want to contribute to the workforce, and we're making it so incredibly difficult for them to do so. Is that just a government bureaucracy issue? Because like, for instance, I look at the people who are coming in, what do you call it when they're seeking asylum, right?
Asylum.
And then they're getting court dates for like 7 years from now, right? So you see how overburdened and what a mess that system is. And obviously the worker visa system is totally separate, but is it just overburdened or is it just not functional? I mean, what's happening there that makes that so difficult? You have someone, they're here to work, they've got a job lined up. Why is it such a challenge to make it work more seamlessly?
I think probably you could point to a lot of bureaucracy there. And plus, you know, over the last several years, it just doesn't seem to be the workforce out there that there used to be. People aren't seeking work. I know in the agriculture, you just could not find enough people. And so maybe it's a combination of things, but the system has truly been overloaded, overburdened, and doesn't work. And like you said, those court dates on into the future, 5, 7, whatever, 10 years, what are the chances of those folks showing up for that court date?
It's zero, Congressman. It's zero. Yeah.
Probably.
I wouldn't show up. I mean, you're already like been here a decade by then. So I guess what's your fear given, you know, regardless of your race outcome, but like the presidential race, if it's a Kamala Harris presidency versus a Donald Trump presidency on some of those issues at the border and related immigration issues?
Well, you know, neither side has been very open and willing to truly address the problems that we've been talking about here. And I think there's a growing amount of realization and also a sense of urgency. And maybe people are starting to understand that if we fix the system where people can come in legally, they won't necessarily then try to sneak across. Mm-hmm. And there's always going to, we're never going to stop that to zero, bring that to zero, but to a point where we could manage those that are trying to come in illegally. And I truly think, you know, that the both sides are starting to come to this realization. So I can't tell you which side is going to be better on this issue. I don't know. I do know.
You really can't tell me which side would be better on the border crisis issue?
On fixing that problem.
Oh, gotcha.
I do know that making sure our border is secure,
yeah.
Republicans have a much better track record on that.
Well, what is it like for you to see the Kamala Harris ads about, oh, I'm going to be tough at the border?
I've not seen those.
You haven't seen them? Oh,
they're not playing them in our part of the world.
She's like, I was a border state prosecutor, I prosecuted drug trafficking.
We've had record numbers of people coming across the border. Maybe not the last 6 months, but the last 3.5 years, it's been. And I've been to the border several times and seen it. One of the things that struck me, I was talking to some of the border mm-hmm. agents one time. They asked me, Mr. Congressman, who do you think controls this border? And I was expecting them to say, well, Border Patrol does or something. They said, it's the cartels. The cartels tell people when they're going to cross the border. They tell them where they're going to cross the border. And of course, they tell them how much it's going to cost them to cross the border. Yeah. We don't have control over our border. That is a terrible situation to be in. I've stood alongside, I'd say, thousands of yards worth of material waiting to be installed at the border crossing. Mm-hmm. All these fences that you've seen pretty pictures of, there's a whole bunch more of that stuff that's just sitting there in the sand, rusting.
Over politics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That we've paid for. The contractors were there ready to put it up. And this administration stopped that. You see these communities that are close to the border and what they have to go through because of what's happening, these people coming across, the criminals that are coming across, people that are... There was a small town in South Arizona near the border crossing where I was at. We had a community meeting. There were several members of Congress. I took the Western Caucus down there, which I'm chairman of. And they were telling us things that, oh my gosh, a lot of those people don't even lock their doors anymore. Mm-hmm. Because you know why? They're just going to get them kicked in anyway. So they leave them unlocked so they do less damage when people break in to steal food or clothes or whatever they want.
It's sad.
Yeah, it's sad. And then they're racing through town trying to, you know, get away from the authorities, the law enforcement, trying to get them up to Phoenix or wherever the people are taking them. It's just a very, very unsafe situation.
Well, it's similar, a different issue, but to downtown Seattle where people leave their car's unlocked and they put a little sign that says, my car's unlocked, there's nothing in it. So they don't get their windows broken in, you know, when things get out of control. Did you support the bipartisan border deal that was derailed?
That was a Senate measure. Yeah. It never came to the House.
But did you support it in principle? I mean, obviously it's getting a lot of attention. Democrats are saying that Donald Trump killed it, essentially.
I don't know what really happened with that, but since it never made it to the House, we never got a version of it.
Yeah.
I'm always in favor of anything we can do to secure our border, make our border much more strengthened and secure. I think there were some things in there that people said, the Border Patrol even said were good about it. But there were some things that people were saying, well, that's not such a good thing. So it didn't get to us. We didn't have any paper, anything to look at that we could consider. So, but there's a lot of support for doing exactly what we need to do to secure our border. And I think we're going to get it done. I think that Republican policies are better for our country. And we have a much stronger track record on keeping our border secure.
Yeah. I also want to ask you, I've got you here, about energy policy.
Oh yeah.
We have a lot of the state level it's been challenging. I mean, you look at the Climate Commitment Act, you know, people who want to breach the dams. I mean, the efforts to ban natural gas. There's so much going on from the perspective of farmers and ranchers and folks in your district. What are some of the key issues they're having with some of the environmental regulations or energy policy?
So I'm, like I mentioned, chairman of the Congressional Western Caucus. And, we focus on those issues that are important to rural America. And energy is certainly one of those. This administration, on day one, literally day one, took action that set us back who knows how long by canceling the Keystone XL pipeline. So many different things have happened over the last 3.5 years that changed the United States from being an exporter of energy to being dependent on foreign countries for sources of energy. And I think we need to go back to making sure that we can utilize those resources, that we can extract, we can process better, more environmentally responsibly than any other place in the world. And I think that if we can do that, we'll get ourselves back on strong energy footing. And this is kind of becoming a cliche, I suppose, but what I've been telling people, the answer to our energy needs is literally right underneath our feet.
Yeah.
Now, I'm all for a cleaner environment and making sure that we are responsible stewards of this earth that God gave us, but we can't flip a switch on fossil fuels and be totally off of them tomorrow. They are going to be part of our energy future for a long time into the future. And so we've got to do those things that are as smart strategically and environmentally as we can. And that's securing them from the United States of America.
Yeah, I know this is a state policy, but I'm sure you hear about it a lot. The Climate Commitment Act, you know, they were supposed to be farmers, ranchers, truckers. They were supposed to be exempt from the
what happened to that?
That's a very good question. Mm-hmm. And they're not. And they've had to sue over it. I mean, to the extent where it's written into the law for them, but they still had to sue. I've spoken to the Washington Farm Bureau. I mean, they say hundreds of family farms are closing every single year. So what are you hearing about the very real sort of pinch that our farmers and ranchers are feeling right now as a result of some of those policies?
There's, well, like I talked about before, the cost of doing business for agriculturalists, for farmers, producers, ranchers is through the roof. Yeah. And the prices generally for the things that we produce have literally not kept up. In fact, if you talk to a wheat farmer, they'll tell you they're getting the same price for what they produced in the 1970s.
Wow.
It's tough out there, and we are losing farms. And the policies that, whether they're in Washington, D.C. or Olympia, make a tremendous amount of difference. The cost of energy, you know, literally makes the wheels turn on farms or in industry. And when we're paying so much more than other producers in other states because of a mistake or something that was an oversight in one of the agencies that was responsible for putting in this exemption for agriculture, that just makes us uncompetitive. And, you know, already adding to the cost that we're already having a very difficult time absorbing. And so it's, you know, this is a, sometimes I get feeling a little cynical, mm-hmm. unfortunately, when it comes to what is happening statewide here. I wonder sometimes if the state of Washington truly wants an agricultural industry, because it's making it so difficult to be successful. The costs that are continued to be piled up on top of producers, it's untenable.
Well, from the overtime pay debate they had in Olympia and all of that. And it's like, I said on the show today about small business, but like, if you were trying to tank the agricultural industry in Washington, would you do anything different than they're doing now? Like, if this, it seems like a roadmap to put farms and ranchers out of business.
Yeah. The overtime thing, you've mentioned that. Mm. Oh my gosh. Can you think of another example where legislators have just been deaf to the voices of the people?
Yes, I can.
Well, this one is a good example.
Yes,
maybe
it is,
you've got a better one. But
I can think of many, but this is a great example.
They wouldn't listen to the producers, the farmers, the ranchers. They wouldn't listen to the farm workers. Hundreds of them descended upon Olympia telling them, we don't want this.
Yeah.
But the legislators knew better.
Yeah.
And now we're finding ourselves probably in a position, I'm told by some of my friends in Olympia, that in the legislature, that we may be faced with a supermajority situation.
Yeah.
And so, Katie, bar the door.
Well, what would that mean for the people in your district who are already ignored and, you know, shunned and all of that? I mean, anyone west of the Cascades, it's like they don't even exist. But we could have a Governor Bob Ferguson. We could have at least a supermajority in the Senate, and then maybe also in the House in 2026. I mean, that has to have people who are making their living off the land very worried.
It's got to. And, yeah. And you mentioned the Farm Bureau talking about how many farms and ranches we're losing.
Yeah.
It's a sad scenario. People have worked not just their lives, but we're talking about multi-generational farms here. People that have worked hard to pass it on to the next generation. And you don't get that back. That does not come back. Farms consolidate. They get bigger. They be venture capitalists buy things that take mm-hmm. over big parts of our industry. It's completely changing the landscape of what a family farm used to be.
Are the Chinese still allowed to buy land here?
They are. We've been working on that too.
Okay.
That's been a huge priority of mine, that we start to get a handle on what's going on with foreign purchases of agricultural assets in this country.
Right.
So I've got legislation passed the House. It's going over to the Senate now to get that, tighten that down so we know what's going on. You know, there's a lot of foreign ownership of a lot of things in mm-hmm. our country. The one thing that we can stop, we should not allow, is ownership by countries, people in countries that are not our friends.
Right.
That are not our allies. And the biggest one there is China, the Communist Chinese Party. Sometimes I'm criticized for doing this. You know, you're China, you're being xenophobic, and this isn't really a problem, and why are you worrying about this? I'm not being xenophobic. I'm focusing on the Communist Chinese Party, which last time I checked is not our friend. And this issue over the last decade, Brandy, China has bought an ever increasing amount of farmland in this country by a factor of 10 over the last 10 years. That's how much it's growing. So to me, wouldn't we be better off to stop this before it's a huge problem?
Yeah.
Instead of waiting 5, 10, 20 years and saying, oh, wow, we should have done something about this.
Well, it's so obvious.
Right.
It's like, why would we give one of our adversaries control over large swaths of like American right. soil and production of food and
or processing yes. or shipping yeah. or and it's grown beyond the critical links in the supply chain. There's instances around the country where Chinese investors are trying to buy land near military installations or important pieces of infrastructure around the country. So I just think we need to wake up to, okay, let's get smart about this. Let's mm-hmm. be a little more strategic in how we let things happen in this country. So we're taking steps to make sure that the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States at that table, the Secretary of Agriculture now will have a seat and be able to monitor these things. We haven't done that before.
Yeah, we're making it so hard on family farms. And it's like, come on in, China. Right. Like, you know, they're going out of business, so you can take all their land. But, you know, obviously there's a lot at stake on so many different fronts in this election. Everybody feels it, the costs, all of that. Why should the people of your district give you 2 more years?
Well, like I said, I'm from the district. I understand the issues. I mean, these are the same issues that I face on our farm, our family does in our community. And so I live them every single day, much, much more so than somebody that just moved over from the West Side a few years ago. And so I think my track record is proven to be good. The things that I've been able to accomplish for the people in my district, the things that I stand for, the things that are important to me or what's important to my neighbors up and down the 4th District. So, you know, as humbly as I can say, I think I've done a good job. And I've still got the fire in the belly to continue to do that, to stand up for what I believe is right and to stand up for what's important for Central Washington, Washington State, and the United States.
And if it's you get another term and former President Donald Trump is back in office, yeah. can you work with him to better the lives of Washingtonians?
I worked with him before and I can work with him again. Like I said, Republican priorities are better for our country. And if he's elected, I want to work to make sure he continues to push conservative Republican priorities across the finish line and work to make him as successful as I can.
All right. Congressman Newhouse, if people want to learn more about your campaign, your policy issues, if they want to support your campaign, how can they do that?
DanNewhouse.com. Go to my website. We've got all the information they could want, probably more. But look forward to a successful campaign year and serving my constituents for 2 more years.
Piece of cake. I love it. I've already told you, Mike and I's retirement properties in your district.
Oh,
so
that's
I
right.
need that district in tip-top shape for when we come out there and retire. So.
That'll be a long time from now, Brandy.
Oh, don't remind me.
But it'll be in good hands. Don't worry.
Well, though. I appreciate it. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
And I guess we'll see how things go.
Very good.
Thanks for listening to this Election 2024 interview. To listen to other interviews we've done with candidates this cycle, check out our website at undividedpod.com.